she was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice, and as always, I'm here with
Elizabeth. And today we have an interview with Krista Seh, creator of the Pussy Hat Project and author of the new book DIY Rules for a WTF World: How to Speak Up, Get Creative, and Change the World. Welcome, Krista.
So the first question actually that we had was about the Pussy Hat Project, because that was really a huge undertaking and it kind of took on a life of its own. So our question was, how do you let go and trust that everything will work out? Or do you?
That's such a good question. It's so much juicier than like the normal questions I get of like, how many pussy hats have you made?
We like juicy.
Patriarchal. Oh my God. Let's talk about like the intuition behind it. Like, I have a chapter in my book about this, about make plans, let them go, because I really think that for a project like this, you need to use both sides of the brain, the right and the left. And so definitely it took a lot of planning, but at a certain point I had to really trust. It's a lot like having a child. At a certain point I had to trust that the project knew what to do, like the pussy hat knew what to do. If I just let it be, like, you know, I love working this way of just pouring my heart and soul into something and then releasing it, you know? And I definitely have some control tendencies, as maybe some of your listeners have as well.
Yeah.
And the Pussy Hat was a really good training ground for me, or proof even that, like, you know, when I treated a project with a lighter touch, like it really took off, you know, like, you know, after I poured myself into the project, I was able to let it go. And, you know, I still supported it by doing interviews and spreading the word and, you know, making pussy hats and things like that. But a lot of it, I just had to trust that women and craftivists across the world would just really take to the message. I didn't have to sit down one by one and convince them, you know, like either they were in or they were out. And like, I was really lucky that they were in.
There's a really great illustrated timeline of the project, the Pussy Hat Project, at the end of the book that shows how quickly you went from kind of idea to movement. Was knitting the hats and putting the project together really cathartic after the election? Because I found after like points of like serious stress, like I defending my dissertation or whatever, the first thing I wanted to do was something with my hands that involved very little actual intellectual work and was very much focused on just creating something.
Yes, you completely captured it. I think, you know, like I'm a screenwriter and a, you know, book author and artist, and I find that when I'm on the screen a lot, like just like whether it's for your job or whether for, you know, the movement, you happen to be on the screen a lot, like, you know, people ask for donations or they're on Twitter or they're spreading the word about something through email. There's a lot of screen time, and it was such a relief to have an outlet where you're creating something. I know when I've been on the computer for a long time, and I'm going through a draft over and over and over again. And of course, you know, the draft is getting better, but for that primal part of my brain, it's hard for the primal, that animal part of me, to understand that like there's progress being made, you know, because it's just the same screen with like slight adjustments and slight word changes. Whereas like when I'm knitting, my animal side is so happy because it's like, oh, look, another row. I could feel it. I could touch it. I could hold it. And I think that's a gift we can give ourselves with knitting or crafting, where we can actually see a project from start to finish and touch it and hold it and feel it and like have that tactile experience of giving it away. I think, like, you know, we can metaphorically feel that in our other projects, but sometimes we need like a grounding ritual, concrete symbol of doing that. So I think the Pussy Hat really filled a need for myself and others by doing that.
Yeah.
Are either of you knitters or? crochet.
I have knit in the past. I am not as good at it, I don't think. Nothing that I necessarily have ever produced is something that I could sell, and that's fine with me. I enjoy doing it. I have made myself many scarves. I've made my husband many scarves. I really enjoy, and I'm sure I'm going to bastardize this name, but amigurumi, the little tiny critters and figures that you can crochet. I love the shit out of that. And I have made, I've made a ton of those, which I really enjoy.
Oh my gosh. I'm really impressed. Tried to make those and I kind of gave up. Like, I think I made one teddy bear and I was really proud of it, but like, I was like, this is not my
my problem is that I crochet and knit really tight, so that actually is the perfect format for me, because it has to be really tight, so it's perfect.
Yeah, I'm completely untalented when it comes to crafting, you know. It's just I admire everyone who has like the slightest hint of a talent when it comes to those things, because I can't.
But you know, I do think there's something for everybody in this. I think like when I felt like I was bad at like drawing or something, you know, it's like I find that like if I just let that go, like I can draw some semblance of something, and then it's enough to like be able to collaborate with other people.
Yeah.
And you know, my mom doesn't craft at all. Like, she's like, I don't know. I feel like she's like, I had this realization recently that my mom is the ultimate cool girl. Like, such a thing. Like, you know, like she'll watch sports, she'll do whatever, she will like, and she's like very unemotional when it comes to like, she's very practical when it comes to like expressing what she wants, you know? And so, like, and I'm not really that way. It took me a long time to discover, like, oh, it's because my mom is so cool that I thought I had to be that way, but I don't. Like, you know, and she doesn't craft. She doesn't, like, sew. She doesn't cook. And, you know, I think sometimes she feels oddly, like, ashamed of that, because my grandma is the one who taught me how to knit, and her little sister, my aunt, is really good at it, like knitting and crocheting. Like, she's someone who doesn't need a pattern. She just sort of tries a couple things and boom, all of a sudden it's like this beautiful piece of art.
That is, I'm very envious. I can't do that.
Yeah.
No, that's my Aunt Celia. And anyway, I think my mom was feeling really put out during the project, and she was just like, what can I do? What can I do? And I think that's the beauty of the Pussy Hat. It's such a weird thing to do for a cause, in a way. Like, it's new that it wasn't just about like, hey, this is for knitters and crocheters. It was really for everybody, because it brought to mind like, hey, like, I don't knit, but if you know, this counts as activism, surely I can do something, you know? And you know, like people with like a radio show, our first radio interview, this woman in San Francisco was like, hey, like, you know, I'm terrible at knitting, I love this project. It occurred to me, like, hey, I have a radio show. Maybe that's my way to, you know, help support, you know. And people who like just weren't afraid of heights, like, but didn't knit, like would climb these huge statues to put pussy hats on top of, like, you know, so like everyone could like contribute somehow, and in creative ways and in really personal ways. So I think that's what really made the project take off, like beyond just the knitting and crafting world.
I think that's really interesting. My mom is very much like your mom, that she didn't get taught any of those kind of crafting, sewing things from her mother. And when I had my first ballet recital, you know, they have costumes and they expect the parents to make the costumes. And my mom went into this fabric store and was like, I'm at a loss. I don't know what the fuck to do. And one of the other moms came in and she looked at my mom, and instead of like mom shaming her into like, I can't believe you don't know how to do this, she was like, do you want me to do it? If you pay me to do it, I will totally do it. And my mom was like, yes, I'm just going to hand you the materials and you can take care of this, because this is not my thing.
Yeah. Like, I remember I went to an eighth grade or something. We had this like Greek recital chorus thing. We all had to wear like, you know, white dresses and like, you know, and I needed like my hair, like and my mom was like at a loss that morning. She was like, I don't know. And like what to do. And then like, and I went in with like the saddest braids ever. Like, and it's funny, I actually felt more sorry for her than for me that day. Like, you know. but yeah, she definitely has other skills. I don't know. I think the Pussy Hat was a really great way to do that. And I talk about in my book about finding and owning your superpowers, you know? I think, especially the early team that jumped on board, I think the reason why it was so easy for them to, and so easy for me to ask, actually, was, like, for example, Aurora made these beautiful illustrations that I think really set the tone for the Pussyhat very early on. And, you know, it's not like I went up to her and asked, like, hey, Aurora, can you, like, shovel snow for the movement? I was like, hey, can you use your superpower, do this thing you're really good at and really enjoy for a cause you really believe in? And it was the same with Kat Coyle. I asked her, like, if she would knit a pattern, you know, and I wasn't asking her something that was really hard for her to do, you know. So I think it's actually, in a way, a design problem to versus, like, a human problem, right? It's not that, like, oh, the humans are bad and don't know how to knit or how to sew a costume. It's more like allocation of resources and skills, right? And Liz, your mom, found someone who could do it easily. And I think that's just it's just a really cool thing. And I think social media really helps with that too, because people can, like, chime in and pitch in, but hopefully not with things that, like, make them feel awful. Like, you know, like, cause definitely there are people who I think feel, like, really overextended, you know? But I do think that when you pitch in with something you really enjoy doing, it's not nearly as hard, you know?
I totally agree. DIY projects and craftivism, that especially, like, knitting and crafting have often been considered traditionally, like, feminine pursuits. And in chapter or section 31 of the book, I can't really call them chapters because they're like lessons, like little bite-sized lessons. But you talk about choosing the people.
Like, you could just, like, pop a few in a map or eat the whole box.
But you talk about choosing the people that you please. And you mentioned how that you're doing feminine things for yourself or for people who you choose and not because of some rule that the patriarchy has, like, imposed it on you. So I guess the question is, do you see taking back these sort of DIY activities and doing them for alternative purposes, differently valuing them? Do you see that as empowering?
Oh, completely. I mean, crafting, first of all, is, like, kind of like the ugly stepsister to art, you know, like, it's really looked down upon. Like, when, you know, I think a lot about content and form, I'm, like, art history trained. That's what my degree is in. And, like, I think the content of what I am suggesting and we are suggesting in feminism can feel really out of the box and different, like what, women deserve this too, you know? And I think it's really fitting to match the form of how we express this in a revolutionary way as well, or a very feminine way, and asserting that also very, very, very valid. So I think choosing to use craft versus art, and to use something feminine versus masculine, and to use something kind of considered private instead of public, you know, like, are all choices that even further drive forth the message that, you know, there's no one right way to do something and our way is valid as well. So that's really important to me. And I do think, you know, a woman's right to choose goes far beyond reproductive rights. You know, that's super important. I feel like we don't even realize how we're giving away our power to choose, even in small moments. Like, you know, like if your mom was like, oh my God, I'm such a bad person because I never learned how to sew, that's her choice to, like, berate herself. Or she could choose to say, like, oh, like, I'm so busy doing these fabulous things and I'm going to, like, creatively delegate this to someone who would be happy to do it. Like, you know, that's her choice to view it that way. Whereas the patriarchy is very, like, keen on, you know, supporting that first scenario, right? Like, oh, it's all your fault. And so I think, like, when we reclaim our right to choose, it goes into these even very small moments of our day that really, really add up. So, and it includes, like you point out, like choosing, like that chapter 31, choosing whom you please. Because I think that the issue, the problem was probably my mom's generation, which is why she didn't, you know, learn how to cook or to sew, was because it was considered lesser, right? And she had to, like, you know, perform on a higher level and learn more masculine things. And I think we're at an age now where it's like, you know, these so-called lesser feminine things are actually really important and can mm-hmm. be very valuable. Mm-hmm. But how do we do them without feeling like we're giving into a stereotype and like, you know, giving up on achieving? And
yeah.
there is to reframe the situation, I think, and to acknowledge that to shunt them off to the side is actually patriarchy as well. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I was on a panel with the editor of Bust Magazine, and she brought up that, like, you know, when a girl like dresses up in a Batman costume or she joins the flag football team, like, we really applaud that. Like, oh, good for you, right? But mm-hmm, when a mm-hmm. boy picks up knitting needles or likes the color pink or likes a princess movie, we're like, oh my God, no, that's not okay. And what are we teaching kids with that type of attitude, right? So I think really valuing these skills we have.
One thing that just came to my mind is a quote by Gloria Steinem, because she said, we've begun to raise daughters more like sons, but few have the courage to raise our sons more like our daughters. That just came to my mind when you talked about masculine traits in women being valued much more than feminine traits in men.
Yeah, you know, my friends and I have been talking about a lot about how much we let men get away with things, and we very much don't let women get away with the same things, you know?
Very, very, very true. Yeah.
And, you know, I work in screenwriting, and I think, well, like, for example, like, my brother recently, like, I was honored at City Hall. My grandmother, who doesn't like going out anymore, came out, and my dad and my other brother, my mom, and my brother, who lives like 10 minutes away, didn't come, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really strange because I realized, like, oh, like, if he were a girl, he would have been, like, lambasted for that, you know, because he was available, he was close by. And he just was like, you know, didn't feel like it. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting that, you know, I know that wouldn't be the case if he were a woman, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in screenwriting, my friends and I have been talking about how women only take a risk in an appreciated way when they've just had a huge divorce or a breakup, or they got fired from their job. And when they have nothing, it's like, well, okay, I guess I can like open the business I actually want to, or date the men I actually want to, or, you know, all these very like risky things. And that kind of carries over to real life, that when a woman takes a risk because she wants to, it's very, very much picked apart. Whereas like men are kind of seen as, oh, like, you know, the story is just written so much more differently. Like, I think about this, you know, obituary of Steve Jobs, and he was like described as like perfectionist, you know, and he would yell at people, like, you know, to get them, like, oh, genius, you know. And I was so angry by that, because like, if he were a woman, it'd be like, oh, she was such a bitch, and she didn't know how to get along with people and all these things. And so anyway,
the question is always like, is the fact that we have had these so many of these narratives in television, in movies, in every romantic comedy, in every Hallmark movie, whatever, is that shaping the way that we are, or is it a reflection of what's going on in culture? And I think it's probably a little bit of both, but I think that the more we have stories that are not of women only making these choices to be bold when something catastrophic has happened in their lives, but
it doesn't earn the right to take a risk, you know?
Yeah. Like the default is that women are allowed to be very bold in their decisions, and that they can do things that are maybe scary to them, and then that's okay. Then kids that are seeing these movies, younger women who are seeing these movies, then they begin to see that, oh, this other stuff that I've been taught my entire life, that's bullshit. Like, this actually speaks more to me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
I think having examples really, really helps. But, you know, I'm like kind of on that. I'm also in that world of, you know, writing these things that, you know, indoctrinate and brainwash, you know, the next generation. And, you know, it's really interesting, because I think, you know, I find that like these writers, I work with a lot of different writers, and I have a lot of friends who are writers. And it's not like we're out there trying to like, how do we push forward patriarchy today? Like, you know, but I think it's something about like when you write with stories, you're writing with symbols, and, you know, to some degree you're using the symbol and what's already impacted that symbol, yeah. right? So when you write a joke, there's the writer BoJack Horseman did this great article about it, and it kind of goes to a joke writing principle of like, don't put a hat on top of a hat, right? Mm-hmm. So like if the joke is, I don't know, that this man thinks he's like more handsome than he is, you like as a joke writer, like, okay, like what's like the best way to describe that? And it's like, oh, maybe it's like a balding man, yeah. right? But then again, now you've written like, you know, a man into a screenplay and it's like one less, you know, role for a woman and all these things. But like if you put like an Asian woman in the role, mm-hmm. It's not that the joke writer is racist or anything, but like for the quote unquote purity of the joke, it's like he's now afraid that the audience won't get the joke as much because like there's like this whole like, there's all this baggage that the Asian woman arrives with that they're like, oh, is the joke about this or that, or the fact that, you know, there's mm-hmm. yellow fever involved. Like all of a yeah. sudden people don't know what to think of it. And so that's not exactly his fault, but I do think
we can do better.
We can do better. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it boils down to like, we get what the joke is. Like we understand that there's this cultural baggage. There's this cultural coding that we have, but like, as a society, maybe we can do better in terms of what we think is funny. And, you know, my husband doesn't like a mm-hmm. lot of female comedians. Like, okay, fine. He doesn't get the humor. I think most female comedians are fucking hilarious. But like,
yeah. I think women are better than men, yeah. whatever.
But he like, just doesn't get it. Like he hasn't been exposed to that many female comedians. He like any number of things. The things aren't something that he can relate to. But
yeah.
as a society, like, you know, maybe it takes a little more to think of a joke that's like funny and still is inclusive and to write a screenplay that includes more people of color and includes more diversity and includes actual people of color playing the roles of people of color.
Yeah.
You know, but it's worth it. I think ultimately down the road, it is totally worth doing because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. And I do think that it's really exciting too, because you know, as an artist of any medium, you're always working with people's assumptions, but then you push them mm-hmm. forward, right? I think that's what the mm-hmm. that did. That, like, yes, like it played upon, you know, certain things that we associate with handmade objects and feminine clothing and the color pink, but I think it brought it to a new level, you know, and asserted new messaging with it, right? And I think that's what's necessary in all these different mediums, particularly a medium as powerful as the movies yeah. and TV.
I want to loop back to the Pussy Hat Project for a second. After the first Women's March, there was a whole debate surrounding kind of transphobia and the pussy hats that criticized the hats for focusing on genitalia and being trans exclusionary. What did you think about this backlash?
Yeah, I had a whole journey with that because at first I was just, you know, like, I kind of reacted to what I thought like the surface level stuff of like, you know, it was, you know, from day one, day zero, we stated that it was an inclusive project that it was open to transgender, cisgender, you know, men, women, like any race and so forth. And I think it was, and it, you know, for me, the word pussy doesn't just refer to genitalia, although I think that's something that, you know, we don't want to ignore either. And Regina Thomas Hauer, she goes by Mama Gina, wrote this really great book, well, several of them, but her latest one is called Pussy. And she goes into depth on it more than I can right here, right now. But it's she talks about how for her, pussy refers to like the whole divine feminine. And that's how I tend to see pussy because it actually, for me, stands for all the things women are taught to be ashamed of that we really should be really proud of, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, sometimes that does involve actual vulva, but it's about so much more than that. And so it's so much more inclusive than that because in that sense, we all have divine femininity in us. And like, you know, but at the same time, I basically come to the conclusion that I think the pussy hat is doing the job it needs to do. You know, I don't regret making it. I don't, you know, I think like it's done so much good. And, you know, I hate the idea that people would feel, especially like you know, because it's not like this criticism isn't coming from like a Republican man being like, I don't like this. It's like, oh, whatever. Like, you know, it's coming from someone like I, you know, who we're on the same side. But I realized that, like, I think what they're saying is so important, and I'm glad they're speaking up. You know, that's what my whole book is about. And it did occur to me, like, oh, maybe, like, you know, maybe I would prefer if they spoke up in a more positive versus negative way, like if they came up with, like, a symbol to show that versus, like, you know, tearing down a symbol that means so much to many women's rights supporters. But like, I realized for me, I just couldn't really stand by that because to me, that's being hypocritical. You know, like when the Pussycat first came out, people, and they still do, are like, oh, we need like a more dignified symbol than that. Like, you know, like don't protest today. Like, you know, and like for me to say like, oh, like, trans community, don't protest that way, like, you know, like come up with your own symbol. It's like, no, like I don't want to be that patriarchal voice. And it's really like, you know, I think the best example I could come up with is like with Colin Kaepernick. Like, I would never tell Colin Kaepernick, like, don't kneel at a football game, like don't protest that way because football is sacred, you know, like don't do that. And like similarly, I think like I don't want to tell anyone, don't protest using like the pussy hat in this way. I didn't intend to, because, you know, that's, I'm not about controlling the pussy. I'm about spreading it and letting people use it as they wish. And if they use it in a way to show what they find wrong with white feminism, because it is like an apt symbol for that when it's, you know, for a lot of reasons, which even though it wasn't my intention, and I'm Asian American, and
I was going to say, as a woman of color, like how how do you feel about, you know, someone saying like, oh, this is a product of white feminism?
You know, I personally don't think that, but if they choose to look at it that way, that's their prerogative, and if they're choosing to use that to point toward a more, like, you know, move the movement towards something more intersectional, like, I think that's great, you know. And I also hat really, when it comes down to it, is language. It's, that's what it's meant to do. I think after the Women's March is on the cover of Time, the cover of New Yorker, and all these political cartoonists were drawing the pussy hat into their cartoons. And that was such a huge moment for me because, you know, they weren't drawing the pussy hat to like advertise the pussy hat or spread the word. They were just using the pussy hat to further other ideas. And I think that's what the pussy hat really is there for. And, you know, I think if people have the right to choose what they want to, which ideas they want to further, like whether it's like feminism needs to be more intersectional, I'm going to like use the pussy as shorthand to describe that, or what women like are, is not invalid, like, you know, and we're going to use the pussy to that. I think that's so important. And it's really to keep the conversation going and to show that it's not an invisible thing, you know. I mean, like, it's pussy hats are far from invisible, like, you know, it's not like wearing a safety pin that's very subtle, like, you know.
The safety pin, like that to me was like the ultimate like old lady white feminist thing.
What does the safety pin mean?
It was meant, if you put it, like, you put it on your shirt or sleeve or whatever to indicate that like you were a safe person.
Yeah. Okay. I think I came across it one day.
Do you remember in what context that was? Whether it was racial or whether it had to do with LGBT?
I think, I want to say it was racial because
I think so.
The Muslim a mosque had been attacked. It's so funny how quickly like things change, right? I'm like, oh, that feels like ages ago. It was like
a year ago,
maybe. Like, oh gosh, I'm really happy that it furthers the conversation. Like, you know, recently, or a few months ago, someone put a pussy hat on a Harriet Tubman statue, and people in the Black community in the area, like, you know, it caused this debate. It was like, you know, some people in the Black community felt that it was co-opting a symbol of their movement and that it was disrespectful, where some people felt it was an inclusive gesture, and also within that Black community, right? And I think like what's very uncomfortable to acknowledge in our patriarchal world is that there is no right answer, right? Like, and that's like really uncomfortable. And But I do think that's the feminine way that we, like, paradox and femininity go together much more easily, right?
Yeah, it's a lot like the intersectional feminism. And, you know, everybody wants to have, like, an answer, but maybe the answer is that there are a lot of different answers.
Yeah.
Right. And I do think that it's, like, complete bullshit when, like, you know, it's sort of like the left, the women's movement, they can't even agree. So why should we listen to them? And that's, like, such bullshit because, like, you know, if two white men were to argue in public, like, you know, neither man would be discredited. And, like, the men's white men's movement would not be discredited as a whole. Whereas, like, when two, you know, like God forbid, two women of color disagree on something, it's like, oh my God, like the whole movement doesn't have it together.
Yeah.
Until they get their shit together.
But and we've seen two white men arguing on television every night, right? I mean, yeah. CNN has it, Fox News has it. Every single news channel has two white dudes arguing it out.
Right. And that's like, you know, like totally normal. Whereas like we're somehow supposed to be this perfectly united front when we never like disagree with one another and like that's the only way we'll win. Like that's not true, you know. I think there's this weird expectation of perfection and purity that sometimes, like, honestly, even I forget about until I take a breath. I'm like, oh wait, I don't need to like perfectly get this across or perfectly agree.
Yeah,
it's okay.
What one of the things that you talk about in the book, one of the like as a bunch of the advice, I would say much of the advice in the book deals with anxiety and fear, and by extension, and this is maybe not explicit, but this is kind of what I got from it, the issue of imposter syndrome. And as an academic, we talk about this a lot, how we're constantly doubting that our ideas are good enough or whether we are good enough or whatever. Obviously, I think people suffering this can benefit from internalizing some of the lessons of this book.
Yeah.
But what would you say maybe the three quickest things that folks can do to confront their like imposter syndrome and stop it in its tracks? Like, I would say more than 50% of the lessons are ways to deal with imposter syndrome. But what would you say are your kind of top three when you're encountering it?
I think the first one would be chapter 5 of the valid stamp, because oftentimes when I, you know, am feeling like I'm not good enough or I'm a fraud or the imposter syndrome, as you put it, it's because I'm imagining that there is just one right way of doing something and I'm not doing it that way. But the valid stamp reminds me that there is no one right way of doing something. And that's like patriarchy's biggest victory, really, that like they've tricked us into believing there's one right way of doing something. And, you know, if you're a woman or a person of color, just not a part of the ruling class, then like, guess what? Like the way you're doing it is wrong, you know? Yeah. And just seeing like breaking through that haze of patriarchy and seeing how fucking effective they are being from like, you know, petition standpoint, like, oh, that's really effective of them because they're tricking all of us is like a really great way to like to like acknowledge like, oh, that's why this is happening, you know, and I can take a breath and realize like, you know, when I give into this, they're winning, but when I acknowledge that it's not real, I'm winning, and so that's really important to me to remind myself that just because the way I do it isn't the way other people do it doesn't automatically make my way invalid or like make me an imposter, right? If anything, it makes me like really creative and out of the box and innovative, right? So that reframe I think is really important. I'm just riffing, but that actually kind of leads me to the second one, which, you know, the chapter called Grow Your Garden of Friends. I think like with your friends to just bring this out into the open versus like these deep, shameful like secrets, you know, is so important. And then like if you were all kind of trained as friends to, you know, be really open about our desires, you know, because I think what's odd is that like it's not just our achievements that we feel like imposters about. Like I think we feel like uncomfortable even about the simple things we like, you know. And I talk about that in the book too, that when women like something, it's a shameful, fraudulent thing, right? That like, oh, like I was so bad. I watched Millionaire Matchmaker and ate chocolate and drank wine or all these things. You know, these are things like I enjoy doing, you know, and yet we're so ashamed of that. Whereas like you never, ever, ever hear a man say like, I was so bad. I like stayed in and watched Monday Night Football and drank beer.
Well, like, and the fact that we call them guilty pleasures, like, fuck that. I shouldn't have to feel guilty about what about binge watching some trash TV show. Like,
you shouldn't feel guilty about pleasure.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Like, men like don't feel guilty about it, and I think that really frees up a lot of their like bandwidth, honestly. Yeah. Like, you know? And we need to give that gift to ourselves, you know, because we have become self-policing. It's not just men who are like, oh, like you watched that show, you drank, you ate that stuff, and you didn't go out. It's women, and it's ourselves who do it to ourselves. Yeah. Like, we've become so, you know, that's my hope with the book, to like unlatch that and let ourselves be kinder to ourselves, because that really does ripple outward. So I don't know. So yeah, there's more than one right way of doing something. Like what you like. It's not a guilty pleasure. And I guess thirdly, to combat imposter syndrome, I think it's really getting to know yourself that's so important, and also finding that an important part of your life. I think, you know, I talk in my book about feeling like a blank check, trying to keep myself blank in order to be ready for whatever someone might want of me. But to actually like take a stance and be like, oh, like, no, I'm good at this. I'm bad at that. I enjoy this. I, you know, like really finding yourself fascinating enough to like get to know yourself, because when you know yourself that well, like you are authentic and you're the opposite. And I think we've been really encouraged to not get to know ourselves very well, you know, instead to like keep ourselves kind of at these default settings so we can be frankly accommodating to men, you know? So yeah, I think that, I mean, like, I think the whole book is helpful toward that, but yeah, like off the top of my head, those are three areas I think.
Yeah.
That I reach to first oftentimes.
Yeah. Sure. So what are the next projects you're going to be working on after that book? What are you up to? What are you passionate about?
I'm working on putting more stuff on my website, like lots of content that like interactive, you know, because I think like there's so much good information out there. But my question is like, why aren't people accessing it, particularly when it comes to mental health? So I find like more fun ways of, you know, presenting that information. Because I think that's, in a way, I think that's like my purpose in this world, right? Like, I think of my real job as a, you know, I'm a writer, I'm an artist, but like my real job is like a travel agent or a magician, where I'm just like, you know, like, oh, let me take you, like, I've been on this journey before, let me like make it as easy and fun and comfortable and luxurious for you as possible. And the magician part is like, you know, I think sometimes we get so stuck in ways of like, oh, this is how the world is and we have to be reasonable. And a magician's show just disrupts that for a brief moment. You're like, oh, wait, how do we do that? Like, you know, is that possible? Like, the Pussy Hat was like an amazing like act of magic. And so yeah, I you know, I have more stuff coming out, whether it's in TV or books, but especially on the website. So yeah, like I think if people check out christasa.com, you know, sign up for the newsletter, follow me on social media, like I do try to like stay like, you know, I like as an artist, I like to do different things. So hopefully you know, so there'll be some happy surprises coming
up. I downloaded the book plates today. I'm very excited to get started reading 100 books of by women and women of color. That's going to be my gift to myself this summer.
Oh, I love that. Oh, thank you so much.
So we know that you have to go because you have to check out of your hotel. But thank you so, so much for sitting down to talk with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
This was really fun. Like I, yeah, as I say, like I would love to wake up and do this every day. And then I was like, oh, I shouldn't say that. And it sounds like I was really lazy this morning, but you know, it's true. I just like rolled out of bed, took a shower, hopped onto here, just had this great morning with you guys. Thank you so much.
Aww. Hashtag life goals.
Yeah. I'm rusty, but I'm just doing it from bed. So, you know,
one
right way to do something. Right? So. All right. Have a great day, ladies. Thank you so much for having me.
You too. Thank you for talking to us. Bye. Thank you for listening to this interview. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter at She Persisted Pod, and on Instagram. You can write us an email. That's shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. We also have a homepage, that's shewhopersisted.com. You can listen to us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, basically anywhere you can listen to podcasts. And until next time, stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.